You are about to enter a seminar I was teaching on countering the counter-missionaries. Our focus is going to be on messianic prophecy.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks, friends, for joining us this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. Michael Brown, as always, delighted to be with you. This week, we have a whole week of special programming as we're away on a special family vacation. And rather than playing repeat broadcasts from the past, we have specially prepared the broadcast for this entire week, taking you into live sermons that I've preached, or today, a seminar that I taught on countering the counter-missionaries, where we focus on presenting Jesus, Yeshua, as the Messiah. We have a study guide that we finally put together after several years of having a DVD series out. Study guide put together. It's not printed yet. So for information on the teaching that I'm giving today and how to get the whole presentation, it's a 22-hour class with study guide. Stay tuned. In future weeks, we'll talk to you about that. But right now, let's get into this teaching that will bless you, open your eyes, edify you, help you. Welcome to Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. We're going to begin to look at some of the scriptures and God's ongoing work in history, in the world, why we know that Yeshua is the prophesied Messiah. And then we're going to begin to look at some of the issues that come up in terms of how do we interpret messianic prophecy? Are there principles? And then we're going to look specifically at some of the objections, some of the issues to these verses. So on your outline, notice where we say it must be Yeshua. So just a few points. When we're talking about Yeshua, the Messiah, we are talking about one of us, okay? As we said, this is not the son of Mr. and Mrs. Christ, the Gentile founder of a Gentile religion. This is one of us. This is our own family kin. I don't know if you ever heard the silly story, but there's a Jewish dad and a Catholic dad at a graduation at Harvard, and Jewish dad says to the Catholic dad, so what is your son going to do after graduation? He says, well, he's a very religious man, and he's actually thinking of going to seminary and going to the priesthood. And the Jewish father says, that's it? He said, well, no, he's very serious and thinks perhaps one day he'll actually be like a bishop. And the Jewish dad says, that's it? He said, well, no, look, one day, who knows, he could even be like a cardinal in the Catholic Church. And the Jewish dad says, that's it? He said, well, I don't know, I mean, look, perhaps one day maybe one day he could even be the Pope. And the Jewish dad says to him, that's it? He said, what do you want him to be, God? The Jewish dad says, one of our boys made it. Anyway, it's a silly little joke, and we can get into all kinds of theological issues of what we mean by the deity of Yeshua. But the fact of the matter is, one of our boys made it, okay? Now think of this. Jesus is the most influential Jew who ever lived. Period. More human beings worldwide, literally hundreds of millions, have become worshipers of the God of Israel through him. More than through any other person, Jew or Gentile. If you say, well, that's just the result of, Judaism gave birth to Christianity. Well, hang on. Either own it or disown it. If you want to disown it, say it's alien, it's false, and it's not for us, and he's not one of us, and he's not the Messiah, fine. But if we're going to take credit, let's recognize that this Jew, Jesus, who lived and died in a small area, in a short period of time, and never went out of that area, has had more of an influence for God worldwide and brought more people into the knowledge of the God of Israel and brought more people to read the Hebrew scriptures as their own scriptures. They sing the Psalms, they read the words of wisdom of Proverbs. All right, we're going to take a brief break and we'll be back continuing with this presentation on messianic prophecy.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Michael Brown here. Thank you so much for joining us on this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. Today, I'm not taking your Jewish-related calls or answering Jewish questions. We're taking you into a seminar I taught, part of a 22-hour class on countering the counter-missionaries, and we're talking about presenting Jesus Yeshua through messianic prophecy. Let's get right back to the teaching. They're waiting for the completion of redemption and praying these prayers in accordance with the prophets. That's the result of the work of Yeshua. More than 100,000 Jews around the world follow him as Messiah today. Throughout the centuries, thousands of Jews have followed him. Yes, there's a remnant that believes, but there's only a remnant. It's a larger remnant. There's only a remnant of our people today that's Orthodox. In fact, many times in our history, it's the remnant that's been right. Although Jews are often repulsed at what Christians call the incarnation, God's word becoming flesh and dwelling among us, it is actually a key to many mysteries in the Hebrew scriptures. We'll open this up in a day or two as we talk about the nature of God. And it's the way that the eternal, inaccessible God comes to live among us. In other words, Yeshua makes God fully accessible. There was a reason there was a tabernacle. There was a reason there was a temple. There was a reason God made ways for people to approach him. There was a reason he revealed himself in different ways. This is how the eternal, infinite, transcendent God makes himself known to finite mortal beings. This is how the God that, according to the New Covenant Scriptures, John 1:18, no one has seen this God. According to 1 Timothy 6, the same thing, speaking about our God. He dwells in unapproachable light. No one has seen him or can see him, and yet somehow he makes himself fully visible to us through his Son. It's a mystery, but it's God drawing near, and we have hints of it throughout the Hebrew Bible. He was a true prophet. He predicted the fall of Jerusalem and the destruction of the temple, predicting our people scattering, yet predicting an end to the time of the Gentiles. What other significant Jewish voice spoke up in that generation and prophesied the things that have befallen us for the last 2,000 years? No one. That should tell us something. He came when the prophet said he had to come. No other messianic candidate has fulfilled or can ever fulfill those credentials because he had to set in place, set in motion, begin, usher in the work of redemption before the second temple was destroyed. So here's what it means. We have the deposit. We have the down payment. His first coming serves as the deposit and guarantee that he will come again and fulfill the rest of the prophecies, whereas traditional Judaism has no guarantee that the Messiah will ever come. One rabbi in a debate quoted words of another rabbi of past generations saying, "Woe to the world if the Messiah has already come." He's already come, and this is what the world looks like. This was from a quote hundreds of years ago. Woe to the world. My response is, since he had to come and do certain things in a certain framework, certain time frame, if he didn't come and do those, he'll never come. Then we can really say woe to the world. At least we have the first part, the deposit, the down payment, the guarantee of the rest. Traditional Judaism doesn't have that. He fulfilled key prophetic scriptures, dying, rising from the dead, as the prophets foretold. This is not something you can plan. It's difficult to plan your resurrection. He's the one to whom the sacrificial system and priesthood pointed. He's the long-awaited priestly and royal Messiah. And we need a Savior now. Judaism's view on the condition of the human race is too positive. We're a flawed, fallen race, and we need comprehensive salvation now, not later. Yes, Judaism recognizes that there is a battle, that there is an evil nature and a good nature, and the evil nature has to be subjugated. That's understood. But even the most religious Jews that I talk to would not rely on their own righteousness, but rather on the mercy of God. I was talking to a rabbi the other day, and he said to me, "Mike, what if someone from the first moment of birth to the end of their life, every thought, every deed, every action, every desire, was 100% perfectly in accordance with the will of God, doing the will of God, honoring God, pleasing God? When he dies,
And God, in his justice, should he reward that person? And I said, yes. He said, no, because that person only did what was right to do and what was given to them by God. In other words, they didn't do anything that they should be rewarded for. Everything they get is by way of mercy. I said, you're never going to argue with me about mercy. I said, I believe in mercy. I said, that's our whole message, that everybody fell short. So God, in one act, has mercy on the whole human race through the death of the Messiah. I said, all the more for God's mercy. For more than 2,000 years, Jews have been unable to follow the literal commands of much of the Torah. If you say, I want to take Torah seriously, I want to follow it, most of the commands laid out cannot be followed. We're going to look at that in detail later in the week. Yeshua saw this coming. He predicted the destruction of the temple, and he gave us a better way. Through him, you can truly know God and experience lasting forgiveness of sins and receive empowerment to live a holy life. And as I've asked other Jews and rabbis, can you say for sure Jesus will not be the one that comes that you're waiting for, expecting, that rises up? As a nation, we've been wrong before. Our religious leadership has been wrong before. And as a people, we've certainly been preserved by God for the last 2,000 years. But have we had the evidence that our religious choices were right? Have we been blessed with the promised covenantal blessings? Perhaps we've been wrong about the Messiah. At least should bring a humble question in the heart of Jewish people. Perhaps we've been wrong about the Messiah. So again, reiterate, no other worthy messianic candidates have arisen in the last 2,000 years. The Lubavitcher Hasidim, following their grand rabbi, the Rebbe, Menachem Schneerson, very influential Jewish leader, has spread a certain form of traditional Judaism around the world. It's continued to grow after his death. But it's always very interesting to me when I say, okay, well, so you're telling me he's a messianic candidate. Let's compare his influence, especially with bringing the light of God to the ends of the earth. And you're comparing, you know, the dust in the balance, even if it's very lovely dust, with the weight of Yeshua's life and mission. No other worthy messianic candidates have arisen in the last 2,000 years. Yeshua fulfilled the essential prophecies that had a definite time frame and had to be completed before the second temple was destroyed. And he identifies with us in our suffering. There's a tremendous moving story that Elie Wiesel tells. Some of his Holocaust writing, I relate it in volume 1 of Answering Jewish Objections to Jesus. I have a whole section there that deals with the Holocaust. And to be perfectly honest, I had put the question there because Jews will raise it, and how can you explain the Holocaust? I can't even think about Jesus. What about the Holocaust? And I thought, I need to address it, but how can I possibly address it? Who's worthy to address it? And the magnitude of suffering. And no matter what I say, it's going to be blamed and criticized. And I wrestled with it, and I saved it for the end of the book. And then I really felt God began to open some themes up to me and give me insight. And I ended up writing one night till 5 in the morning, just so overcome with the reality of some of these themes. And Elie Wiesel talks about a horrific instance where a young boy was hung by the Nazis, but because his weight was not heavy enough to break his neck when he was hung, that he just jerked and suffered. The minutes went on and on and on, and everybody watched him dying this agonizing death. It just went on and on and wouldn't stop, this young Jewish lad. And the question was, you know, where is your God? Where is your God? And Elie Wiesel's response, there. You know, there he is hanging on the gallows. Of course, there's all kinds of meaning that Wiesel had in this. But when I read it, I was just struck by that same picture. You know, where is your God? There, hanging on a cross. He's not separated from us. He's not just looking down. We don't just have a Messiah that just one day shows up in glory and power. He's one of us. We've been a suffering, rejected, despised, misunderstood people. So is he, as one of us. We've been the subject as Jews of world hatred. So is he. Often hated without a cause. The same spirit behind anti-Semitism is the same spirit behind hating Yeshua. We have a Messiah that identifies with us in our suffering and pain and need. And that's why there's so many parallels. That's why there's even a debate. Does Isaiah 53 speak of Jesus, or does it speak of the nation of Israel? Because there's been a parallel of suffering. Only he, however, has brought the healing and redemption. So he is the ultimate example of the suffering, persecuted Jew. Think of it. No Jew has had more influence in world history than him. No Jew has brought more people into the knowledge of God than him. And no name is hated by more people than that name. Interesting, isn't it? Every day, thousands of people around the world are coming to the God of Israel through him. And it's only through Jesus that we, the Jewish people, can fulfill our calling to be a light to the world and a priestly nation.
All right. Got to take a short break. We'll be right back with you. Again, this is part of a 22-hour teaching series on countering the counter-missionaries, a whole class you can take on DVD. We have a study guide right now proofing it and hope to have it published soon. As soon as that's available, I'll be announcing this entire course to you, how you can get it. But I want to wait until the study guide is available before I share more.
God of light, hear our cry.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome back, friends, to our Thoroughly Jewish Thursday broadcast. Michael Brown here. I trust you're blessed, encouraged, and helped by the truths we are presenting here. If you have questions, if you differ with me, hey, plan to call next Thursday and to share your questions about Messianic prophecy or your differences with me. Right now, we're getting back to the seminar that I taught on countering the counter missionaries, talking about presenting Jesus Yeshua through Messianic prophecy.
Okay. The answer to us seems so evident, so clear. He has to be the Messiah. It's the testimony of Scripture. But are the Messianic prophecies that clear? Can we really draw the conclusions as powerfully as we did? Can we be that sure? Over the years, I studied these issues much. All the professors I studied with through my college and grad school were not believers in Yeshua. Some of them were somewhat liberal in their thinking and had a critical view of Scripture. And I saw many good points in their interpretation of Scripture and that others I couldn't accept. So I wrestled with these things for years. Some passages I read and reread and read and reread for years and years and years. So, okay, what is this really saying? Is this truly messianic? How should this be interpreted? And just asking God honest questions. I've got a massive library in many languages and just dive into it and study and get on my face before God with the Scriptures open and ask for insight. I'm going to give you eight principles that on the surface seem very, very simple. But they actually were the result of more than 20 years of consistent meditation on the Scripture and asking God for insight from His Word. And if you have volume 3 of Answering Jewish Objections to Jesus, this is the volume that focuses on Messianic prophecy. We have this as a special appendix beginning on page 189. So I'm going to give you eight principles for interpreting Messianic prophecy. Seven are in the book, and the eighth is here. In fact, you get some previews of some pages from my commentary on Jeremiah, which should be out in a year or two whenever it gets its place in the series, as well as from Volume 4 of Jewish Objections, which is due out at the end of this year, 2006. Then there's Volume 5, 6, 7, 8, no, hopefully 5 will be done. Okay, first principle. Now, again, these are going to seem really simple, but the more you've worked on this, the more profound they're going to be. In fact, let me just state this up front. I have very little scientific background, okay? Obviously, I can read things and understand what seems right and wrong in scientific discussion and evaluate like anyone else, but I have very little scientific training, all right? If someone came up to me, a student in our school of ministry, said, Dr. Brown, I've made a breathtaking discovery. It's going to change the whole face of our understanding of science and the universe. And I've discovered it. And let's say this is decades and decades ago. And they came to me and said, I've discovered the theory of relativity. First, I don't, okay, what does that mean? What is the theory of relativity? No, look, here it is. E equals mc squared. And it's going to change the 20th century. What are you going to think here? Over E, that's it. E equals MC squared. This is, nobody ever figured this out before. You just got this. You're the first one. And this is going to change the 20th century. That would be our assumption. But if you had enough scientific knowledge and information and physics and all the other sciences involved with that, you'd read it and see the mark of genius on it. You'd read it and say, ah, wait a second. This. Then you start to calculate and it'd almost be like revelation. Some of these principles hit me in the same way, almost like revelation. They're ridiculously simple. Which when you look at them, it's like, yeah, duh, so. But most of us don't have these presuppositions. So some of these are ridiculously simple. And even when I open them up, they're going to seem simple. Some have tremendous depth. And the more you work with them, the better you'll understand and appreciate them. Okay? So first principle, da-da. Messianic prophecies are not clearly identified as such. Messianic prophecies are not clearly identified as such. You know, sometimes you get into a whole discussion with somebody just based on a wrong presupposition. You're having a whole discussion about the wrong subject. No, we had an appointment for today. No, you had an appointment for yesterday. No. Oh, actually, we're in the wrong place. Sorry, we didn't have an appointment here at all. You get so into it. My first time preaching in Italy, it was 1987. And so we stayed in Italian homes, so that meant someone was translating for us back and forth. I'd pick up just little bits and pieces. Otherwise, everything's back and forth, Italian, English, English, Italian. I'm preaching, they're translating into Italian. Someone's talking to us, they're translating into English. Just constant, nonstop. So one day, we're standing there. It was after a big open-air meeting we did. And a pastor comes up to my translator. So here's the translator, here's the pastor, here's the translator, here's me, my wife Nancy with me, we're standing there. And the pastor says, in English, to my translator, we're having a big gathering at our house tonight. My translator then turns to me and says, they're having a big gathering at their house tonight, and we all nod. And he said, we're going to have a number of the pastors coming together. Translator turns to me, they're going to have a number of the pastors coming together. We're going to have a big bowl of pasta we're cooking up. They're going to have a big bowl of pasta. And I said, wait a second. Wait, by the third sentence, I said, wait a second. He's speaking in English. But none of us realized, we were just so used to translating, that this guy spoke to my translator in English, who then repeated it to me in English, and we all nodded and through the process. The third time, I said, wait a second. He's speaking in English. Sometimes it's like, wait a second. We get into this whole debate. Well, look, according to the Bible, the Messiah is going to do this, the Messiah is going to do this. Well, stop for a second. Where does the Bible clearly say this is a messianic prophecy?
Okay, we've got to take another break now in our teaching. You can listen to the entire broadcast later, the entire presentation, by going to AskDrBrown.org and just clicking on latest audio. That's always up within a few hours of the completion of the show, thanks to our faithful team that works hard to get that right up for you. And it's free. You don't have to subscribe to get that. And friends, would you help us continue to make thousands of hours of material free online, video material, audio material, and then constant floods of written material? Would you help us do that? Would you partner with us? My special thank you gift today, if you haven't heard yet this week, we discovered, this is not some hype made up thing, God forbid we'd ever trivialize something like this, but we discovered that we had a case, at least one case left, of numbered volumes from the first run of our Real Kosher Jesus book in hardcover and numbered. And what we did with those folks who pre-ordered for a gift of $50 to help us with publishing costs, we sent that out to them. So each book is numbered, and then I sign them to you, and they're inscribed with a scripture verse. So your gift of any size, again, a suggested donation of $50, but some can't afford that. So I want to be able to send this to you as a gift. Others can give more. So pray whatever's in your heart. Our thank you gift will be a signed, numbered hardcover volume of The Real Kosher Jesus. Call right now, 1-800-278-9978. That's 1-800-278-9978.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
This is Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. This is Michael Brown. Instead of taking your calls, questions today, we are taking you right into a seminar that I taught, 22-hour class on countering the counter-missionaries. This is a presentation on presenting Jesus Yeshua through messianic prophecy. If you miss any of the broadcast, if you're just tuning in now, go to my website later today, askdrbrown.org. You'll be able to listen to the entire teaching, which will be spread out over 2 hours of broadcasting today. This is part of a 22-hour series we have on CD and DVD. I'm just not announcing it today because we finally have prepared a study guide. We hired a professional study guide preparer to get this done, and we've got a top-flight study guide, several hundred pages to go with this. As soon as we have that printed, we'll announce this resource to you. Right now, let's get back into the teaching.
Where does the Bible say, okay, just stop, we're talking about issues in our own day. Okay, it's going to be very intense in the coming days. There's going to be this and this and this. Okay, now let me just change that. Messianic prophecy. Here it is. When the Messiah comes, he will do this, this, this. Okay, now back to the discussion. Messianic prophecies are not clearly identified as such. When someone says, it says the Messiah will be a royal king, you say, could you show me that passage? Where does it say the Messiah will be a royal king? We all know the word Mashiach, anointed one, was used for various people in the Bible. The high priest, HaKohen HaMashiach, the anointed high priest. Any king of Israel was a Mashiach of the Lord, an anointed one of the Lord. Saul, a king who came under God's disfavor, same as David. Cyrus, the Persian king, in one famous passage in Isaiah, is called a Mashiach of the Lord, an anointed one. The prophets could say that the Spirit of God had anointed them. So this concept, the Messiah, you do not have passages that clearly and explicitly say, okay, stop, this is a prophecy of the Messiah. Even Daniel 9, which many of our translations in verses 24 to 27, many of our English translations say the Messiah. The Hebrew there doesn't even say the Messiah. It speaks of a specific anointed one, a clear messianic figure, as I understand the passage. But nowhere does it say this is a prophecy of the Messiah. Therefore, when a rabbi says, when the Messiah comes, he'll do this and this and this and this, according to the Bible, you say, based on what interpretation? Based on my understanding, the Messiah will do that and this also. So that's the first thing you have to understand. Even deciding what is and is not a messianic prophecy is a matter of interpretation. Now the question is, do we have a right interpretation or a wrong interpretation? Can we sustain our views clearly scripturally? This is what God was speaking about. Of course, I'd say without question, 100% yes. But it's not clearly laid out. This is a messianic prophecy. And I was doing a debate with my friend Rabbi Shmuley Boteach some months ago. And he would keep saying, when the Messiah comes, he'll do this, 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 this. Jesus hasn't done it. He can't be the Messiah. And I got up and said, look, according to the Bible, the Messiah is going to do A through Z. Shmuley's saying he hasn't done N through Z, he can't be the Messiah. I'm saying he has to because he's done A through M. Therefore, he's the only one that can do N through Z. Well, afterwards, a guy came up to me and said, yeah, but I didn't understand that point because he was saying, according to the Bible, the Messiah is going to do this, 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 this. And no matter how many times I made the counterpoint, the guy didn't seem to get it, that the Bible didn't clearly lay out he's going to do 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. This is the work of the Messiah. We must identify who is the Messiah. What does it mean to have a messianic prophecy, and then from there conclude that Isaiah 53 is just as messianic as Isaiah 11. Simple point, but one we need to make up front. Second point, the messianic hope in Israel developed gradually. The messianic hope in Israel developed gradually. I didn't say it developed gradually in God's heart. I didn't say that God gradually came up with this idea.
Okay, quick break, and we will resume. Michael Brown, thanks for joining us on this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. Send your questions, comments to us at askdrbrown.org.
Oh,
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thank you so much for being part of this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday broadcast. Michael Brown, blessed and delighted to be with you. We are taking you into a presentation I taught, part of a 22-hour class called Countering the Counter-Missionaries. This is Presenting Jesus Yeshua Through the Messianic Prophecy. We will resume right now. Any Christian here is familiar with passages in the New Testament that speak of Jesus as a lamb slain before the foundation of the world. In other words, before the world was created, as God foresaw what would happen in his creation and what he would do to bring creation to himself. This was destined. But the concept, the understanding of Messiah grew gradually in Israel. And this is according to the biblical evidence that we have. So let me just explain that. David was a Mashiach of the Lord, right? An anointed one of the Lord. Great ideal, great promise, great power, rules powerfully in his region for a time, messes up in certain ways. His son Solomon messes up worse, then the kingdom split. But hang on. There are some wonderful words of promise given to David in the Psalms, in the Scriptures. We read Psalm 2, asking me, I'll give you the nations for your inheritance. That never happened. Psalm 110 to David or to one of his sons who rule in the future, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies a footstool for your feet. When did that happen to David? Psalm 72, which could be a prayer of David for Solomon, which the way it's headed up and the way the chapter ends would indicate it was a prayer of David for Solomon. It speaks of his rule to the ends of the earth. This is a wonderfully messianic passage. Was it realized in Solomon's day? No. So what happens? As each new king dies, think of this. Even in America, as skeptical as we are about the political system and so on, we still have hopes. You know, when a new president comes in, this guy's going to do it. And we have hope, or we can just change this a little, or change this, or shift in Congress. It's really going to change the nation. And sadly, the changes we normally see are fairly minimal. This is ancient Israel. This is a monarchy. This is the king. This tremendous hope with each new king born. This is it. This is the guy. He's going to be a greater David. He's going to be just like his father. All the promises are going to be fulfilled. And he messes up. He worships idols. And then a guy with real promise, he gets cut down. And then the temple's destroyed. Then the people are in exile. But wait, we still have these promises. We still have these promises about a righteous branch from David. We still have these promises about a king who's going to rule and reign. We still have these promises about the knowledge of God flooding the earth. So over a period of time, whatever the time frame is, generations, centuries, the hope, the concept of the Messiah, the Redeemer, the great Son of David that's going to save us, that begins to rise among the people. Why is that so important? Many times we'll read a prophecy and say, that's Jesus. And someone will say, I'm going to have anything to do with Jesus. That was a prophecy for like 2,500 years ago. That's not Jesus. That's a prophecy in Isaiah's day. That's a prophecy in Ezekiel's day. Yeah, true, those were prophecies in those days, or in the days of David and Solomon. But they were not fulfilled. They were not realized. None of those kings lived up to the expectation. And then as these words now become part of sacred scripture, the people begin to read, they begin to meditate, they begin to recite these psalms, they begin to remember the prayers, the hope that's passed on through the generations, they begin to say, where is that Redeemer? So the prophecies had a historical context, but they were not fulfilled in their day, and it works its way on over a process of time. And the messianic hope begins to rise among the people. So in keeping with this, principle number three, many biblical prophecies are fulfilled gradually. Many biblical prophecies are fulfilled gradually. I'm going to expand on this and make it into an eighth principle later. When we talk about to fill something up, this glass gradually is emptying, but we could gradually fill it, till it's to the brim, and it's not filled until it reaches the top.
Sometimes people say, yeah, but messianic prophecies had a double fulfillment, a fulfillment in the first day and then a fulfillment later. I wouldn't call it a double fulfillment because it never got filled. It may have had a twofold application, an application when it was spoken and an ultimate application in the end. But the prophecy is on its way to its destiny. Listen, we see a star shining, but we're actually seeing light that's been traveling for all these light years and however long ago it started and then getting here, depending on arguments of the age of the earth and all this stuff, which we're not getting into here. But it's been traveling for a while before it gets here and we can actually see it. Prophecies are traveling down through history. They may have a certain starting point. For example, in Ezekiel's day, Jeremiah's day, they prophesied about Israel's exile. Ezekiel was in exile himself, and they prophesied about the return from exile back to the land. We're going to open that up more in principle number 8. Did it happen? Did the return from exile happen the way they promised? In part. Some of the Jews came back. The temple was rebuilt, but the things did not happen on the scale they prophesied. Were they false prophets? No. Many biblical prophecies are fulfilled gradually. There was an application in their day. There had to be. Otherwise, the scriptures make no sense. And there is an ongoing application, again, in our own day, as there's a mass return of Jews back to the land in the 20th century, now into the 21st. And will reach its fulfillment with the culmination of these promises. Many biblical prophecies are fulfilled gradually. The same with messianic prophecies. So, for example, Zechariah 9:9-10 speaks of Israel's king coming, righteous and having salvation, gentle and riding on a donkey. And then it says his rule will extend from sea to sea and from the river to the ends of the earth. Did he come in the way it was spoken? Yes. Meek and lowly, died, suffered, rejected, etc. Yes. Is he ruling over the entire world actively in terms of everyone acknowledging, following? No. Is it in process? Absolutely. If you ask the simple question, which Jew who has lived to date has the most likely signs of being the one whom the nations will look to and call their king and bow down to? Only one possible answer. Only one possible answer. Okay, number 4. And this one, it was actually a rabbi, a conservative rabbi that I mentioned that befriended me when I first became a believer, that shared this principle with me. The prophets saw the Messiah coming on the immediate horizon of history. The prophets saw the Messiah coming on the immediate horizon of history. Now, I use the illustration in my book about when you stand on two mountain peaks and you look across, and they look very close, but there's actually a massive valley in between. Now, I've actually never stood on top of a mountain peak, maybe some hills, and done that. But that is the perspective. And many have made reference to it. You're on top of something high, and you look out and see something else high. You don't realize how far, how great the distance is between. Even in our own lives, as followers of the Lord, God can speak something to our own hearts, and we think it's going to happen now. And sometimes now takes 5 years to unfold. We have certain expectation. The prophets, here's the deal. They see judgment coming to their people. They see destruction coming to their people. They see all of the things that God said would happen, of a negative, destructive nature. But now they see a promise. But redemption is going to come. But an answer is going to come. A righteous ruler is going to rise up. And to them, it felt like it was right around the corner. Here, look. Just look at a parallel in church history. Christians, for decades and decades, if not centuries and centuries, have been living with certain expectation of the return of the Lord. And you could make a case that in most generations, believers were living with this sense of expectation. Come on, when I came to the Lord 35 years ago, I heard about people that were like 94. And since they were 16, they were expecting Jesus was coming in their lifetime. And it's got to be soon because they're pretty old. The prophets saw the Messiah coming on the immediate horizon of history. That's why some verses that seem to be applying only to past generations, man, that was a prophecy for Isaiah's day. Yeah, he saw Messiah coming on the immediate horizon of history, didn't realize that what he spoke was for hundreds of years down the line. Now, I'll give you an example from the book of Isaiah. Let's turn to the 10th chapter. During Isaiah's day, the great crisis was the Assyrian crisis. The mighty Assyrian nation with their powerful army that wreaked havoc surrounding countries. God used them as a tool of judgment, but because of their arrogance, he was going to cut them down. So, Isaiah, the 10th chapter, deals with Assyria. Verse 5, woe to the Assyrian, the rod of my anger, in whose hand is the club of my wrath.
Okay, we've got to take one more break, and we will come back and finish out this hour. Questions, comments, to help us with a gift, AskDrBrown.org.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Well, I hope you've been enjoying this broadcast. I hope you've been edified by the presentation of Jesus, Yeshua, through the Messianic prophecies. Tomorrow, I'll be answering your e-questions. This has been a special family getaway time, kids, grandkids together, all 10 of us in a cabin. So I can't wait to come back with reports of not just being refreshed and renewed, but with some fun family stories as well. I don't know what they're going to be yet, but I'm eager to share them with you when we come back. So enjoy this broadcast. Let's get right back into this teaching.
He speaks of how God brought him, used Assyria to bring judgment on Samaria, northern Israel, and even to judge his own people in Jerusalem. But no, they were arrogant. Now they're going to destroy Jerusalem and so on. So God's going to cut them down. So here's the picture now. Assyria is pictured as this great, mighty forest that God's going to cut down. Verse 33. See, the Lord Almighty, will lop off the boughs with great power. The lofty trees will be felled. The tall ones will be brought low. He will cut down the forest thickets with an axe. Lebanon will fall before the mighty one. And then a shoot will come up from the stump of Jesse. See, Jerusalem, Judah, they've been decimated too, but something's going to rise up. Well, hang on. This is as if God's going to bring down Assyria, which happened over 2,600 years ago. God's going to bring down Assyria, chop those trees down, and then out of this little stump, the Messiah is going to rise. I don't get it. That didn't happen. No, the prophets saw the Messiah coming on the immediate horizon of history. He doesn't give a time frame. In this year, this date, Messiah will come, and if not, I'm a false prophet. No, the prophecy doesn't work like that for the most part. The way prophecy works is here's a vision, here's a picture, and he's receiving it. He sees the kingdom in his day coming down and the Messianic kingdom rising. So the prophets often saw the Messiah coming on the immediate horizon of history. That's why many of these things are totally intertwined with the situation of the day. And yet, the Messianic hope rises clearly beyond that. Again, the more you've dealt with these issues, the more useful these principles are. Number five, it's important to read every prophecy in its overall historic context. Wait a second. I thought the New Testament just picks verses out, completely unrelated to context, completely unrelated to historical meaning, takes a verse that had application in Jeremiah's day and pulls it out, and now sticks it in Jesus' day. It's like I'm reading Shakespeare and saying, Shakespeare prophesied about this seminar, and Shakespeare didn't prophesy about this seminar. What are you talking about? Shakespeare is writing poetry hundreds of years ago. What are you talking about? I'm telling you, not that Shakespeare prophesied this seminar. I'm telling you that if you want to rightly understand the prophecies, especially as they're quoted in the New Testament, the Messianic writings, the New Covenant writings, if you want to rightly understand them, you've got to look at the bigger context. Because often the insights were very deep insights, just like the E equals MC squared. You don't see it at first glance. You have to look at the bigger context. One of the objections is that verses are taken out of context. I'm telling you, one of the answers is read them properly in context, as we're going to do in a little while as we start going through Matthew's gospel and look at verses that he quotes. Number six, the Messiah was to be both priest and king. We saw why this was so important in the last session this morning. You see, for years I was told by Christian friends, well, see, their prophecies about the Messiah's king, ruling, reigning Messiah, but there are also prophecies about his suffering. But then a traditional Jew would say, where does it say the Messiah is going to suffer? Where does it say there are prophecies about suffering? I don't get that. Where is it? Key is, the Messiah is both priest and king. And therefore, the suffering passages apply to his atoning death, his intercession, his carrying our sins on his shoulders. And if you cut those out, you cut out an essential part of Messiah's mission. Let me show you something really interesting. Go with me to the end of 2 Samuel. Now, we know, ultimately, here's a good principle. In the best sense of the word, like David, like the Messiah. In other words, David is the prototype. There are even passages in the prophets that speak of the Messiah. They just call him David. I'm going to raise up my servant David. Does that mean the old David risen from the dead? No, it means the Messiah, who is the ultimate David. So David himself did some things that other kings didn't do. David himself actually got involved at times with priestly function. I told you to go to 2 Samuel 8. Just back up for a moment. Go back to... Well, I'll tell you what. Go ahead. Go forward to 2 Samuel. Go all the way to the end of the book here. 2 Samuel 24. It's the end of a plague situation. And what's written here? All the way at the end of 2 Samuel 24, verse 25, David built an altar to the Lord there and sacrificed burnt offerings and fellowship offerings. Then the Lord answered prayer on behalf of the land, and the plague on Israel was stopped.
All right, we are out of time. We will be playing the rest of this presentation in the next hour. So whatever you're going to miss, just go to my website later today, askdrbrown.org. And when you get there, just click on latest audio. You'll be able to listen to the entire 2 hours. This is part of a 22-hour class we have on DVD and CD. But since the study guide is in preparation to be, it's being proofed now, and then we want to get it ready to print, because we don't have the study guide available yet, I don't want to tell you about the whole resource until it's available. And then, if you want, you can take this entire class in your home. To stand with us as we are literally on the front lines of Jewish ministry, to help us reach the lost sheep of the house of Israel, to help equip believers to reach out, to help those who know the Lord be strong in the faith, to help us counter the counter-missionaries, your gifts of support are deeply appreciated. To help us with this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday broadcast and our TV outreach right now, focusing on answering Jewish objections to Jesus, your gifts are invaluable. My thank you gift is a signed hardcover numbered volume from the first printing of The Real Kosher Jesus. We did this as a special promotional offer before the volumes were printed. People paid $50 to pre-order the numbered copies, and it's been one of my great joys on the road to meet people as they tell me what number they got. But we found we still have some left, so we want to send these to you. Your gift of any size, we just ask you to be as generous as you can. Thank you for standing with us. Call this number, 1-800-278-9978. That's 1-800-278-9978. My bottom line today, it is absolutely true. Jesus, Yeshua, is the one spoken of throughout the Hebrew Scriptures, throughout the Old Testament, throughout the Tanakh, the Messiah of Israel, the Savior of the world. You are about to enter a seminar I was teaching on countering the counter-missionaries. Our focus is going to be on Messianic Prophecy.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
This is Michael Brown. Welcome to this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday broadcast. All this week, as I've been away with family enjoying a special vacation time, we have taken you into messages that I preached, live messages, just to give you a different feel. And I didn't want to play repeat broadcast, but it's Thoroughly Jewish Thursday, which means we've got to do something thoroughly Jewish today. So I'm taking you into a seminar that I taught on countering the counter-missionaries. It's part of a 22-hour seminar. Now, we do have this on DVD and CD, but we're in the process of printing up the study guide for this. So as soon as that's ready, I will give you information in the coming weeks or months as to how you can get this entire series. But right now, sit back, and you'll go into this class, the seminar on countering the counter-missionaries, where I explain how to present Jesus, Yeshua, as our Messiah based on the Messianic prophecies. Verse 25, David built an altar to the Lord there and sacrificed burnt offerings and fellowship offerings. Then the Lord answered prayer on behalf of the land, and the plague on Israel was stopped. Did he have people help him build the altar, help him offer sacrifices? All those things could be involved, but the fact is, it attributes the offering of sacrifices to David. This is not something that later kings would do. You have an instance of Solomon engaging in something similar where he well could have been involved in offering sacrifices. If so, it was only as a hint of the priestly loins, the priestly function, the priestly nature. So look in 2 Samuel 8. So what I'm telling you is David himself is a king and the prototype of the Messiah, but David himself performed certain priestly functions and was not smitten by God for it. 2 Samuel 8, verse 17, this is talking about part of those who were in David's leadership. 17, Sadok, son of Achitub, and Achimelech, son of Aviatar, were priests. Seruiah was secretary. Benaiah, son of Jehoiada, was over the Kerethites and Pelethites. And David's sons were, the Hebrew says, Kohanim. That's funny. I mean, verse 17, it referred to Sadok and these others as Sadok and Achimelech as priests. And here, it speaks of David's sons as priests. The same word, Kohanim. That's interesting. Now, there's a parallel passage in 1 Chronicles 18, and it just refers to them as royal advisors. Here, it speaks of them as priests. It's interesting. It's the subject of a lot of discussion, a lot of controversy. But the simple answer is a little hint, just one of these hints by God, just as David himself performed certain priestly functions that other kings didn't. David's sons, it says, were Kohanim. Why did it write that? Why did it say that? Take that up with the Lord, take it up with the rabbi if you like. There it is. And then Psalm 110. Psalm 110, Psalm we'll look at a little bit more depth later on, is David speaking of one of his descendants and calling him his master, his Lord, in which case it's a direct messianic prophecy, is a court poet speaking this about David. There's a far-fetched ancient rabbinic interpretation that the psalm is actually a prophecy about Abraham, which doesn't work for many reasons, as we'll see later on. But this is either spoken to David, in which case he serves as the prototype.
All right, we're going to take a brief break, and we'll be back continuing with this presentation on messianic prophecy for a seminar I taught on countering the counter missionaries. And speaking of Jewish-related subjects, don't forget our Israel tour. Sign up ASAP. Go to AskDrBrown.org, click on the Israel Tour. It's going to be a once-in-a-lifetime experience.
Give us strength to always do what's right.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Michael Brown here. Thank you so much for joining us on this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. Today, I'm not taking your Jewish-related calls or answering Jewish questions. We're taking you into a seminar I taught, part of a 22-hour class on countering the counter-missionaries, and we're talking about presenting Jesus Yeshua through messianic prophecy. Let's get right back to the teaching.
Or it's spoken by David about one of his descendants, a direct messianic prophecy. Verse 4, the Lord has sworn and will not change his mind. You are a priest forever in the order of Melchizedek, which is really the best way to translate those words. Atachohen lo'olam al divrati Melchizedek. So David slash his messianic descendant, a priest forever? How could that be? In some special way, David was associated with priesthood, and therefore it is not surprising that, as we saw earlier in Zechariah, the messianic figure there is a high priest sitting on a throne. Key for interpreting biblical messianic prophecy, Messiah was to be both priest and king. Then number 7, the Messiah is the ideal representative of his people. So, for example, as it happened with Moses in his infancy, Pharaoh, the godless ruler, is trying to kill baby Israelite boys. So also when the Messiah, the greater deliverer, is about to be born, King Herod is trying to wipe out the baby boys in Bethlehem. Israel, in its infancy, went into Egypt. Messiah, in his infancy, went into Egypt. David, the king, was betrayed by someone close to him. Messiah, our greater king, betrayed by someone close to him. David, at times delivered from the jaws of death by the mercy of God. Messiah, delivered from literal death itself to the praise and glory of God. Take a look with me in Psalm 41. I remember a young lady came to me and said, I don't understand this. I sat with this rabbi, and he showed me this verse in Psalm 41, verse 9. Even my close friend whom I trusted, he who shared my bread, has lifted up his heel against me. And the rabbi said, is that a prophecy of Jesus? I mean, the New Testament seems to allude to it. Is that a prophecy of Jesus? And she said, yeah, that's a prophecy of Jesus. That's what happened to him. Judas Iscariot, even my close friend whom I trusted, he who shared my bread, has lifted up his heel against me. And then the rabbi said to her, well, look in verse 4. I said, O Lord, have mercy on me, heal me, for I've sinned against you. Did Jesus sin? She didn't have an answer. I said, oh, no, this psalm is not a messianic prophecy. This psalm is something out of the suffering of the life of David. And he's got a terrible illness and all his enemies saying, aha, see, God's not with him anymore. And he's talking about how he's being betrayed and so on. And amazingly, when Jesus, the Messiah, comes into the world, he too is terribly betrayed. It's just a parallel. It happened with David. It happened with him. That's all. Think of how striking it would be if, just as it happened with Abraham Lincoln and the freeing of the slaves, and then he was assassinated. Let's say hundreds of years later in American history, a great American president rises up who brings complete transformation of the nation, and he too is killed. Wow, what a striking parallel. You just call it a striking parallel. But when the Bible is filled with these striking parallels, again, as I said earlier, it's the whole of Scripture pointing towards him. So the Messiah, the ideal representative of his people, and as I said, he fulfills Israel's destiny. Certain passages, if someone says, is that Israel? Is it the Messiah? I say, yes. Yeah, because it's about Israel, and it's fulfilled through the Messiah, the ideal representative of his people. And then the 8th, and you've got some substantial notes there, so I want you to look on with me. The prophecies of the glorious return from the Babylonian exile serve as the template for interpreting messianic prophecy. The prophecies of the glorious return from the Babylonian exile serve as the template for interpreting messianic prophecy. What does that mean? I had the joy and privilege of working on a commentary on the book of Jeremiah for the new edition of the Expositor's Bible commentary series. Probably wrote about 650 pages. The battle was to keep it to that. It was supposed to be 450 pages, but they were pleased with the material and let me go a little further with it. I finished it around January of 2005, and it's just waiting its slot in the series to be published. But there are a lot of passages that I came to thinking I've got some questions about how this works itself out. And I'll give you an example. Let's go to Jeremiah 23. Jeremiah 23. God rebukes the shepherds who were the kings and the leaders of his day, Jeremiah's day, who were destroying and scattering the sheep of his pasture. And God's going to bring judgment on them. Verse 3 of Jeremiah 23, I myself will gather the remnant of my flock out of all the countries where I've driven them, will bring them back to their pasture, will they'll be fruitful and increase in number. Verse 5, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will raise up to David a righteous branch. There's branch again. Semach. Same one as we find later on in Zechariah, that Semach, the branch, typified by Yeshua, Yehoshua, the high priest. I'll raise up to David a righteous branch, a king who will reign wisely and do what is just and right in the land. In his days, Judah will be saved and Israel will live in safety. This is the name by which he'll be called, the Lord our righteousness, or the Lord is our righteousness. Even debate over those words and how they should be translated. But this is the simple point. It seems that God was saying, okay, I'm going to judge the godless shepherds. I'm going to regather my people. And then David's going to be raised up among them. Okay, so the Jews come back from Babylonian exile, say it's roughly the 530s BCE. Now you expect they get regathered. There are other prophecies that seem to speak of glorious restoration, rebuilding the temple, messianic age. But it didn't happen. I mean, lots of prophecies in Jeremiah. Here's a summary. This is a summary of Jeremiah's expectations by the critical Old Testament scholar, in other words, liberal critical scholar, S.R. Driver. He was a brilliant biblical and Hebrew scholar. So this is what he writes here. You have it in your notes. Not only does he, Jeremiah, promise what actually came to pass, the return of the exiles to the territories of Benjamin and Judah, and the resumption there of the interrupted social life, in which again, as of old, the sounds of joy and life would be heard in the villages. I'm going to skip all the scripture references, but you have them there in your notes. So he said, Jeremiah prophesied these things, and this actually did happen. Shepherds would again tend their flocks, houses and fields would again be bought and sold by the restored exiles. But he invests the future with ideal colors. The exiles of the northern kingdom will share in the restoration. The hills of Ephraim will again resound with happy throngs and be clad with cornfields and vineyards. A great company will return from the furthest corners of the earth. The wants of all will be abundantly satisfied. The national life will be reestablished. Jerusalem will be rebuilt and will be entirely holy to Yahweh. The restored nation is pictured as returning to Yahweh with its whole heart. Words of confession and penitence are put into the mouth of both Judah and Ephraim. The iniquity of Israel will be forgiven and remembered no more. One heart and one way, even the way of Yahweh's fear, will be given to them. Israel will be Yahweh's people and will be their God. More than this, a new and spiritual covenant will be established with the house of Israel, and the nation will be ruled not by a system of observances imposed from without, but by a law written in the heart, filling all with the knowledge of Yahweh and prompting all to ready and perfect obedience. There will be no ark, nor will the ark be either needed or missed. The people will be governed by upright, disinterested shepherds, that is, judges and princes, after God's own heart, and a perfect king of David's line, supreme over all, will maintain judgment and righteousness in the land and ensure peace for its inhabitants. The ruler of the future will be of native birth and enjoy the priestly privilege of access to Yahweh. Israel has but to turn loyally to Yahweh for the nations to be moved by the spectacle of its blessedness to own him as their God. Elsewhere in the books, the nations are depicted as in the future, discarding their idols, confessing that Yahweh alone is God. and looking with awe and wonder at the restored Zion. Israel will never be cast off by Yahweh or cease from being a nation before him. Egypt, Moab, Ammon, Elam, after their expected desolation by Nebuchadnezzar, will be restored. Now, Jeremiah says all this is going to happen. And that quote meant a lot to me because I had to type the whole thing out to put it in my commentary. A lot of material there.
All right. Got to take a short break. We'll be right back with you. Again, this is part of a 22-hour teaching series on countering the counter-missionaries, a whole class you can take on DVD. We have a study guide. We're right now proofing it and hope to have it published soon. As soon as that's available, I'll be announcing this entire course to you, how you can get it. But I want to wait until the study guide's available before I share more. Back with more of this teaching.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome back, friends, to our Thoroughly Jewish Thursday broadcast. Michael Brown here. I trust you're blessed, encouraged, and helped by the truths we are presenting here. If you have questions, if you differ with me, hey, plan to call next Thursday and to share your questions about Messianic prophecy or your differences with me. Right now, we're getting back to the seminar that I taught on countering the counter missionaries, talking about presenting Jesus Yeshua through Messianic prophecy.
But he summed it up so wonderfully. But here's the deal. Jeremiah, in the 25th and the 29th chapter of his book, spoke of 70 years of exile. And after 70 years, God would restore Jewish people to the land. And all this would happen. But it didn't. Well, it did in part, but not completely. It did, but not in the expected measure. Now, I'm not focusing on the Messiah here. All these prophecies. The temple was rebuilt, but not with the expected glory. The exiles did return. But, you know, God's going to make a way in the wilderness, and the whole earth's going to see the glory of God as the exiles return. Instead, it's, you know, this is kind of a band of ultimately about 44,000 over a few years making their way back into the land and the temple. This is the new temple. Yikes. It's not what we remembered. And where is the whole nation's going to follow him with one heart? And did it happen? No, but, well, in part, not according to the expected measure. So for Driver, who was a critical scholar, not necessarily seeing these words as inspired the same way as we would, he felt that the prophets were idealists. You know, God's going to do all this, and it's going to be bigger and better. And exiles are going to return. They just start to dream, and they picture this whole thing. And, well, it didn't really happen, but they were idealists. Well, if we accept the scriptures being inspired and Jeremiah as being a true prophet, we can't simply say that. So, what's the explanation? Take a look at what I've written here. Do you understand the significance of this? Jeremiah, much like Ezekiel, expected that the return of the exiles from Babylon would be so glorious that it would be followed by the transformation of the nation through the inauguration of the new covenant in the reign of the Messiah, leading ultimately to the transformation of the whole world. Were Jeremiah and Ezekiel false prophets? God forbid. Rather, what they prophesied did happen, only not in the expected measure or scope. Remember, the principle is the prophecies of the glorious return from the Babylonian exile serve as the template for interpreting Messianic prophecy. What they prophesied did happen, only not in the expected measure or scope. In other words, in the same way that the prophesied return of the exiles did happen, but not in the expected measure or scope. And in the same way that the prophesied rebuilding of the temple did take place, but not with the expected glory. In the very same way the Messiah did come and inaugurate the new covenant, just as was prophesied, but not with the expected glory or scope. So as I wrote in my Jeremiah commentary, just as the return from exile did take place after 70 years as prophesied, although not with the expected glory, so also the Messianic era began and the new covenant was established, only not with the expected glory. But the historic event serves as the deposit and down payment of the future event, the former guaranteeing the latter, with the return from Babylon in the late 6th century BC serving as the first coming home, while the final eschatological end time return will serve as the second coming home, similar to the Messiah's first and second comings. So also with the establishing of the new covenant. It did begin as promised. The days are coming oracles cannot be pushed into the eschaton in their entirety. Now, that was commentary writing, but just to explain. When the prophet's saying the days are coming, the days are coming, the days are coming, it had to have at least some application in the coming centuries. You couldn't stick it all 2,500 years later. It just doesn't work. Some had to apply to the Jews who returned from exile and the things that happened while the temple, second temple was standing. But the new covenant was inaugurated, touching a much smaller group of people than expected, and still not in its full force. When the Messiah returns, the promise will reach its ultimate fulfillment. Thus, the realization of the new covenant will follow the same pattern outlined in Zechariah 9:9-10, growing from humble beginnings until at the end it encompasses the entire world. Now, you can read all of your notes here in greater depth, and then later in the afternoon, again, we'll take some questions. So I gave you some samples here from Jeremiah commentary and from volume 4 of Answering Jewish Objections to Jesus. But here's why this is so important. I've been studying these passages and these concepts for a few decades when this opened up with total, or I should say greater clarity to me than I'd seen before. When we are constantly told Jesus cannot be the Messiah because when the Messiah comes, there'll be peace on earth, there'll be this, there'll be this, there'll be this, there'll be this, as the prophet said. And we say, well, we're in a transition age. He did the things he had to do before the second temple was destroyed. He is in process of continuing his work through the world. And in the end, it will culminate. It's on a logical progression, reaching its destiny, reaching its goal. They could challenge us, well, where does that happen with other scripture? All of the prophecies here in Jeremiah, all of these glorious prophecies, same principle. Either he's a false prophet because it didn't happen when it was supposed to happen, or it began, but not in the full scope that was expected. Yes, the messianic era began, not with universal peace on earth, rather with a dying Messiah rising from the dead. Yes, the glorious return from exile began, just as the prophets declared, but not with masses coming with a road and highway in the wilderness and the earth seeing the glory of God, but with a number of exiles coming back to the land. Yes, they did rebuild the temple. Yes, the new covenant was established and inaugurated by the Messiah. Yes, it all happened, but in seed form, in earnest, in a deposit, in a beginning way. We are experiencing the realities of the new covenant, but the way Jeremiah prophesied, ultimately the whole earth or all the Jewish people will all know God and you won't have to teach and instruct. We've experienced the seed, the reality, the knowledge of forgiveness of sins, and people come to know God. And in that sense, you don't have to teach them or instruct them or tell them it's happened. They know they've been changed.
Okay, we've got to take another break now in our teaching. You can listen to the entire broadcast later, the entire presentation, by going to askdrbrown.org and just clicking on latest audio. That's always up within a few hours of the completion of the show, thanks to our faithful team that works hard to get that right up for you. And it's free. You don't have to subscribe to get that. And friends, would you help us continue to make thousands of hours of material free online, video material, audio material, and then constant floods of written material? Would you help us do that? Would you partner with us? My special thank you gift today, if you haven't heard yet this week, we discovered, this is not some hype made up thing, God forbid we'd ever trivialize something like this, but we discovered that we had a case, at least one case left, of numbered volumes from the first run of our Real Kosher Jesus book in hardcover and numbered. And what we did with those folks who pre-ordered for a gift of $50 to help us with publishing costs, we sent that out to them. So each book is numbered, and then I sign them to you, and they're inscribed with a scripture verse. So your gift of any size, again, a suggested donation of $50, but some can't afford that. So I want to be able to send this to you as a gift. Others can give more. So pray whatever's in your heart. Our thank you gift will be a signed, numbered, hardcover volume of The Real Kosher Jesus. Call right now, 1-800-278-9978. That's 1-800-278-9978.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
This is Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. This is Michael Brown. Instead of taking your calls, questions today, we are taking you right into a seminar that I taught, 22-hour class on countering the counter-missionaries. This is a presentation on presenting Jesus Yeshua through messianic prophecy. If you miss any of the broadcast, if you're just tuning in now, go to my website later today, askdrbrown.org. You'll be able to listen to the entire teaching, which will be spread out over 2 hours of broadcasting today. This is part of a 22-hour series we have on CD and DVD. I'm just not announcing it today because we finally have prepared a study guide. We hired a professional study guide preparer to get this done, and we've got a top-flight study guide, several hundred pages to go with this. As soon as we have that printed, we'll announce this resource to you. Right now, let's get back into the teaching.
And yet, in another sense, it hasn't fully come to pass yet. So either Jeremiah, Ezekiel are false prophets. Forget messianic prophecy. There are other prophetic declarations for the nation. They're either false prophets or there is a process of fulfillment. And the same as it happened with the return from exile, the exact same way it applies to the Messiah. Sometimes in Jewish commentaries, they'll have this phrase, "V'hamaskil yavin," and the wise will understand. You dig, you search, you look at it, you'll understand the depth of that principle. I'm going to begin to open up this next subject, though, and look at some of the specific challenges to the messiahship of Yeshua. And we looked at some of the clearest passages being in the book of Isaiah about the servant of the Lord, Hebrew Eved, the servant of the Lord. Passages we looked at earlier from Isaiah 42 and 49. The 50th chapter is another one about the servant suffering. And then the end of 52 through 53. All talking about the servant of the Lord. The traditional Jewish response is, yeah, but that's got nothing to do with Jesus. Those are national promises to Israel. They refer to Israel as a nation, Israel as a whole. And they would say, just read through Isaiah 40 to 55, and you'll see the servant of the Lord is always Israel. Let's just examine that. Many of the best insights I've gotten through the years have been by means of a concordance. The theme on which I ultimately wrote my doctoral dissertation on Hebrew and Semitic words for healer, healing, in particular the root Rapha in the Hebrew Bible in the ancient Near East, that came to me, some of the insights, the scriptures began to open. I was on my knees praying about some issues relative to God's healing with my Hebrew concordance open, looking at verses when I began to look. Oh, look at the usage. Look at that. So this is not one of these mysterious things where we have to wonder. Even if you just have an English concordance and take the word servant or servants and look it up, or just read through. If all you can do is read through in an English Bible and mark each time it occurs, you don't have to speculate. Sometimes I'll be teaching our students to say, okay, well, what happened in that passage? I think it was, I said, you know, tell you what, there's a great biblical interpretation principle called look it up. You don't need to speculate or wonder or guess. Look it up. Read it. I would be thrilled beyond words if traditional Jews would simply read through the Hebrew Scriptures asking the question, could this be Yeshua? I don't want anyone to just believe my argument. I want people to study and look and read with an open heart before God and see where the truth leads them. So, servant of the Lord in Isaiah. Servant of the Lord, Hebrew Eved, is mentioned a total of 17 times in Isaiah 40 to 51. I mention this because 40 to 51 immediately precedes 52.
Okay, quick break, and we will resume. Michael Brown, thanks for joining us on this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. Send your questions, comments to us at askdrbrown.org.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thank you so much for being part of this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday broadcast. Michael Brown, blessed and delighted to be with you. We are taking you into a presentation I taught, part of a 22-hour class called Countering the Counter-Missionaries. This is Presenting Jesus Yeshua Through the Messianic Prophecy. We will resume right now.
And it's 52:13 to 53:12, which is the great battleground. I mentioned some of the anti-missionary material early on, that the multi-tape series of Rabbi Tovia Singer, where he deals with this. He actually takes two whole CDs to deal with the subject of Isaiah 53. That's how big an issue it was there. If you look down on your notes, challenges to Isaiah 52:13 to 53:12 from the Jews for Judaism website, look at all these objections. Down onto the next page, why it can't be Jesus. Now, these are done. I'm not laughing at them. These are done with great sincerity of heart. And I know some of the people that work on this website are very sincere people and knowledgeable in different ways. I'm not laughing at them. I'm just saying it's so amazing to see how many issues have to be raised, how many potential problems there are that you never knew existed, having read the passage over and over and over and over. You didn't realize why it couldn't be the person. It's almost like if you're a married man, I've been married now 30 years, here's my wife sitting next to me, and someone's going to explain to me why that's actually not my wife. Give me various proofs and, listen, I know my wife. That's my wife. The same way, two CDs to try to show why this cannot be Jesus. That's one of the examples of nothing plus nothing plus nothing equals nothing, no matter how sincerely it's done. So we just want to look at this first question now. The servant of the Lord in Isaiah, who is the Eved? Eved is mentioned a total of 17 times in Isaiah 40 through 51, sometimes with reference to the nation of Israel as a whole. So I won't read all of these, but you have your references there. And I deal with this in volume 3 of Answering Jewish Objections to Jesus. But for example here, Isaiah 41:8, Vata Yisrael Avdi Yaakov Asher Bechartikha, and you, Israel, my servant, Jacob, whom I've chosen, Zera Avraham, Ohavi, seed of Abraham, my friend. Here's a clear reference. It goes on again. God says to him, Avdiyata Bechartikha, you're my servant. I've chosen you. Masticha, I won't refuse you. So many places it's clearly speaking about the nation as a whole. And I list them. All these verses here. Sometimes with reference to a righteous individual within the nation. As we saw, for example, Isaiah 49:3, where the servant is called Israel, and yet in verses 5 through 7 has a mission to regather Israel. Or Isaiah chapter 50, verse 10. So, Mivachem Yarei Adonai Shomea Bekol Avdo, who among you, so he's speaking to his own people, who among you fears the Lord and listens, obeys his servant, listens to the voice of his servant, goes on there. And the 50th chapter itself with some vivid descriptions into the 51st chapter. So sometimes it refers to a righteous individual. In several cases, it's not clear whether an individual or the nation or righteous remnant within the nation is referred to. Although a good case can be made for the individual interpretation, like Isaiah 42:1 that we looked at earlier, or 44:12. But here's what's interesting. If you go through all your references, take your concordance, just check, just read them all through, this is what you'll find. The most personal, specific, individual language is found in Isaiah 52:13 and 53:11. Okay? So very specific, personal references. Okay? 52:13, 53:11. If you take a look just at 53:11 specifically. From the suffering of his soul, he will see or be satisfied. By his knowledge will my righteous servant make many righteous, and he will carry their iniquities. There are different ways to divide the Hebrew words and translate them, by the way. This servant here, 52:13, 53:11, if you go through the passages leading up to it, here's what you'll find that's very interesting. You go through every reference, you'll find that the last time there is any reference to the nation, clearly, as the servant, is 48:20. Okay? If you'll just go through it, check it when you get home, do a little study. You know, the verses like, you are my witnesses, Israel, my servant, things like that. You don't find any clear language like that after 48:20. So if you just take a look, chapter 48, verse 20. And it ends there, this word, Imru Ga'al Adonai Avdo Yaakov. Say, the Lord has redeemed his servant, Israel, Jacob. There's a clear reference. When you get into the 49th chapter, it starts to get very individual in a way that none of the previous passages were. And then it calls the servant Israel and then says that its mission is to redeem and regather the people. And then if you just look on with me, I'll just read here from the NIV for simplicity and time's sake. Chapter 50, starting in verse 4. 49, very specific individual personal language about relationship with the Lord and dialogue with the Lord and a mission to restore and regather Israel, and yet God's going to make him a light to the Gentiles and bring salvation to the ends of the earth. The sovereign Lord has given me an instructed tongue to know the word that sustains the weary. He wakens me morning by morning, wakens my ear to listen like one being taught. The sovereign Lord has opened my ears. I've not been rebellious. I've not drawn back. I've offered my back to those who beat me, my cheeks to those who pulled out my beard. I did not hide my face from mocking and spitting. This is a more individual picture than you'll find in Isaiah speaking about the nation or the nation speaking itself. This is an individual speaking. Because the sovereign Lord helps me, I will not be disgraced. Therefore, I have set my face like flint, and I know I will not be put to shame. Verse 9, it's the sovereign Lord who helps me. Who is he that will condemn me? Verse 10, who among you fears the Lord and obeys the word of his servant, namely me? Let him who walk, and it goes on from there. So here the servant spoken of in very individual terms. And then we get into the end of the 52nd chapter. And we come to those verses. See, my servant will act wisely, raised, lifted up, highly exalted. Just as many as were appalled at him, his appearance was so disfigured and so on. And he's going to startle or sprinkle many nations. And he's going to carry our infirmities. He's going to suffer. He's going to die. He's going to have his life preserved. God speaks of him as my righteous servant. By his knowledge, he'll justify many, and God will highly exalt him, as a result of which shouts of praise and adoration come in the next chapter. Interestingly, there are Jewish traditions that interpret Isaiah 52:13 and following with reference to the Messiah. In other words, they didn't say if it says servant of the Lord, it must be Israel. Why? Because they recognized that servant of the Lord could refer to the nation as a whole, or the righteous remnant within the nation, or the righteous remnant of one. But suffice it to say, the argument that the servant of the Lord in Isaiah is always the nation of Israel is false. Sometimes, clearly, definitely, it refers to an individual who works for and among the people of Israel and the nations. Therefore, that objection, which is constantly raised, is not only contrary to scriptural evidence, it's contrary to some Jewish traditions that recognize, for example, Isaiah 42:1, behold my servant, as referring to the Messiah. Or Isaiah 52:13, about my servant will be exalted, that refers to the Messiah. Even followers of the Lubavitcher Rebbe, Menachem Mendel Schneerson, that claimed that he was the Messiah, when he had a stroke in the early 1990s, I believe in 1992 when he had a stroke at the age of 90, they began to point to Isaiah 53 because he couldn't speak. And I said, see, he's like a lamb. He's smitten. He can't speak. And point to this passage. So I even talked to some of their rabbis when I was 18. I made reference to earlier this morning in my own testimony. When I talked to some of their rabbis, they said, it's messianic. We believe it's messianic. Right now, Messiah is suffering in heaven. And he's mourning and grieving for our sins and so on and so forth. They had no problem interpreting it in a messianic fashion.
Okay, we've got to take one more break, and we will come back and finish out this hour. Questions, comments, to help us with a gift, AskDrBrown.org.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Well, I hope you've been enjoying this broadcast. I hope you've been edified by the presentation of Jesus Yeshua through the Messianic prophecies. Tomorrow, I'll be answering your e-questions. This has been a special family getaway time, kids, grandkids together, all 10 of us in a cabin. So I can't wait to come back with reports of not just being refreshed and renewed, but with some fun family stories as well. I don't know what they're going to be yet, but I'm eager to share them with you when we come back. So enjoy this broadcast. Let's get right back into this teaching.
So the idea that the servant of the Lord in Isaiah always refers to the nation as a whole is false and contrary to the scriptural evidence and even contrary to some Jewish tradition. What about, though, some of the specific challenges to Isaiah 53? I'm going to list them, then we're going to come back and address them. Here's some of the Jews for Judaism questions and objections. In the tape series of Tovia Singer, he raises the following, that it's the Gentile kings speaking in Isaiah 53, 1 through 9, not the Jewish people speaking. That the servant of the Lord is referring to Israel. That his appearance being marred, I mean, that's even just how Jews have always been mocked as ugly and so on, aside from Jewish suffering. That the context of Isaiah 52 and 54 is all speaking about Israel, therefore it can't be speaking about Jesus. I mean, again, just substitute the word Messiah there and you have to chuckle. It's speaking about Israel, so it can't be speaking about Israel's Messiah. Okay? That the description of him in the second verse, like a sapling, a root out of dry ground, refers better to Israel, despised, forsaken of men, man of pains. That's Jewish suffering through the ages. That the Jews are the ones who have suffered without cause, not the Messiah. How through Jewish suffering, ultimately redemption will come, so on and so forth. These are some of the objections. If you want to know what Isaiah 53 is talking about, just read Isaiah 52 and 54. The context is the return of the Jewish people from Babylonian exile 550 years before Jesus. Isaiah 53 speaks to the people of Israel, not Jesus or any Messiah. The rabbis only applied Isaiah 52, 13 to 15, not 53, 1 to 12, to the Messiah, son of David. It is not true that the medieval rabbis were the first to apply Isaiah 53 to Israel instead of the Messiah. The Israel interpretation is actually very ancient. Isaiah 53 contains the words of the repentant kings of the nations rather than the words of the Jewish people. Several key words in Isaiah 53 speak of a servant in the plural. Isaiah 53 cannot refer to Jesus because it says no one was interested in the servant of the Lord or attracted to him, yet the New Testament records that large crowds followed Jesus. Isaiah 53 cannot refer to Jesus because it says the servant of the Lord was sickly and died of disease. Isaiah 53 does not actually say the servant would die. Isaiah 53 does not say the servant will rise from the dead. Isaiah 53 cannot refer to Jesus because it says the servant of the Lord did no violence, yet Jesus drove out the temple money changers with a whip. Isaiah 53 cannot refer to Jesus because it says the servant of the Lord would not lift up his voice or cry out, yet Jesus cried out several times on the cross, once in near blasphemy, Psalm 22:1. Isaiah 53 cannot refer to Jesus because it says the servant of the Lord would see seed, an expression always meaning physical descendants when used in the Hebrew Bible. Those are the ones I deal with in Volume 3. We're going to continue now on the subject of sin and atonement. And obviously,
for those who are raised in Christian homes, those who've been raised as believers in Yeshua in Messianic Jewish homes, the issue of sin and atonement is way up on the list. And how are you going to deal with your sin? This is displeasing in God's sight, but Jesus paid it all. I mean, this is a centerpiece. Messiah's death on the cross has to do with sin and atonement. If there are other ways to be right with God, if this is not so important, if this is not so essential, it really undercuts foundations of the good news of the gospel message. This is not just a peripheral subject. So we want to look at this as honestly as we can, examining the scriptures. And if something raises a question, we want to wrestle with it and come up with an honest answer. There have been things that I've worked on through the years and written and then gone back and read what I've written as it's being edited and thought, I'm not happy with this. I'm not dealing with this adequately enough. I need to go deeper. There's a further objection that I need to consider. And that'll stay with me. It'll be on my mind until I can really work it through. Again, not coming up with some ingenious way to answer an objection, but to determine by God's grace what is truth, what is written, what is God saying. I want you to look with me in Romans, the third chapter. Romans, the third chapter. The question is always raised, well, what about people that couldn't offer a sacrifice in times past? What about the days before there was a tabernacle or temple? What about someone living in exile, the Babylonian exile? Isn't that the same principle that applies today? On what basis did God forgive sin? Here in Romans, the third chapter, Paul is explaining on what basis we become truly righteous in God's sight. He's explaining that it's a righteousness that comes through faith in the Messiah to all who believe, both Jew and Gentile, since all have fallen short. And he speaks here, verse 23, for all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God and are justified freely by his grace through the redemption that came by Messiah Jesus. God presented him as a sacrifice of atonement through his blood. He did this to demonstrate his justice because in his forbearance he had left the sins committed beforehand unpunished.
All right, we are out of time. I pray and trust you were blessed. 22-hour teaching series on countering the counter-missionaries, a whole class you can take on DVD. We'll announce that to you, how you can get that together with a complete study guide in the coming weeks. Don't forget our Israel tour. Sign up now. The sooner you sign up, the better it is for everyone, as we have to guarantee certain numbers of seats. We want to keep the door open for as many people to come on this trip as possible. So the sooner you sign up, the more it will help others as well, and even help with our logistical planning, because this will be a first-class trip across the board. I'm joined by Dr. Michael Redelnik, Professor of Jewish Studies at Moody Bible Institute. And we'll be doing teaching on the ground. You'll be with us during the tour. I'll be joined by my colleague, Pastor Scott Volk. We'll be doing a live radio broadcast with you as the listening audience, God willing. It's going to be very, very special. So go to the website, askdrbrown.org, click on the Israel tour, and stand with us today. Our suggested donation, $50. But for your gift of any size, I want to send you, it's kind of a collector's item, it is hardcover from the first printing of The Real Kosher Jesus. These volumes are numbered and signed. I'll sign them for you, of course. We discovered that we had some of these numbered volumes left, so we want to make them available to you. Be as generous as you can, but everyone, join in. Take advantage. 1-800-278-9978. 1-800-278-9978. One more time. That's 1-800-278-9978. My bottom line today, God who has preserved Israel, God who has saved a remnant from his people in every generation, that is the God who will turn the hearts of the Jewish people in the days to come.